thought the first thing we might do is just have the panelists introduce themselves and their affiliation.
Hi, I'm Miriam Bellmaker from the Hebrew University.
I'm Paul Bingham, biochemistry and cell biology, Stony Brook.
I'm Margaret Lewis from the Richard Stockton College of New Jersey.
I am Bienvenido Martinez Navarro from University of Tarragona, Spain.
Fred Spohr from University College London.
Kathy Twist, Stony Brook.
Thank you. The way we'll proceed is I'm going to allow the panelists to make any opening statements or comments they'd like to make. Then we will, hopefully that might generate some discussion among the panelists and the speakers. Following that, we'll open up questioning from the audience. And that the people in the audience can address your questions to the panelists or to this morning's speakers. Would anyone like to begin?
I think, the only person among the invitees who doesn't either excavate fossils or study living organisms. I'm actually, in this context, a theorist of social evolution. I would just make the point that paleoanthropology in the last 5 to 10 years, as a result of the explosive growth and the empirical evidence that we've heard a lot about this morning, we'll hear more about this afternoon, and a corresponding increase in our theoretical grasp, has progressed toward the point of becoming a truly mature science, like physics or molecular biology, where theory is not a sort of peripheral and irrelevant part of the enterprise, but is a central and active part, so that the sort of active, mutually reinforcing dance between theory and empirical observation can begin. When a science reaches that level of maturity, it rockets off. That's the point at which things really start to get exciting. And, of course, the Leakey Symposium is making a contribution to bring those two groups of people together. And I thank the organizers, in fact, for the invitation.
All right. Anyone else?
Right. Well, then I will say a few things. There's two points in kind of in response to what I've heard this morning, and more in general perhaps, that I want to make. One is that I think when you think about patterns of dispersal, that we shouldn't be misled by the accident of where fossils are found. That's lesson one that I tell my students, and to my surprise again this morning, and also in some of the written things that I've seen, I heard hints of a common error. It's an accident, in a sense, or an accidental situation that it happens that there were, in the right period, in the east side of Africa, that there was a situation where sediments accumulated that were good for fossilization. And then that there's also tectonic activity that brings these sediments up again so that we can actually find the fossils there. But that doesn't mean that human evolution happened in East Africa only. It just happens so that we find the fossils there. And it might well be, I'm not saying that it's necessarily the case, but that is a complete fringe of a center of human evolution that happens perhaps in West Africa, and we simply can't find any of the fossils. So when patterns of dispersal are being described strictly coming out of East Africa and then perhaps later on to South Africa, where it just so happens that there are caves, that there's karst activity, that there are caves that accumulate fossils, again, a relatively unusual set of circumstances that provides some evidence. It's the connect the dots syndrome of, okay, I have a little bit of evidence here, a little bit of evidence there, so one must have led to the other. Whereas I think it is important to constantly take that into account. The second thing that I wanted to comment on is perhaps an approach to think about the why Homo erectus clearly was the one, seemed to be the one that got out of Africa, and related to that is what I experience as still a frequent misunderstanding of people. I think it was me who showed this interesting cartoon of a hominid progression from a quadruped to a stooped creature getting more and more upright, and associated with that is still very much this idea that you have Australopithecines of some sort, Homo habilis after that, Homo erectus coming out of that, Homo sapiens coming out of that, a beautiful continuation. If you actually look at the dates and at when the fossil record is there, then it turns out that what we really know as Homo habilis and what we know as Homo erectus, of course Homo erectus goes on much longer, but otherwise they completely overlap. It is not the case that Homo habilis precedes Homo erectus as such. Yes, there are about three fossils, and they're very fragmentary and not very informative. that are older than 2 million years old that come before Homo erectus and that have been called Homo habilis, largely because they are more derived than Australopithecines, but not necessarily because they are very similar to the core fossils that we call Homo habilis. So the interesting thing is that between about, let's say, to make it simple, between 2 and 1.5 million years, you have in Africa, we find them in East Africa and a little bit in South Africa perhaps as well, you have Homo habilis and Homo erectus, and so apparently they more or less overlapped, so they must have had different ecological strategies, lived in different environments, did different things perhaps, and one of them actually probably very soon after some speciation event that led to Homo erectus got out. And so one solution that we can look at, even with the fossil record that we have and that we increasingly get now as well, that's part of the work that that I'm involved with trying to find more early Homo fossils, is contrasting those two. And for keen readers of, little advert in between, keen readers of Journal of Human Evolution, soon you will find an interesting paper by Peter Ungar and colleagues where they look at macroware on early Homo and early Homo in the broader sense of Homo erectus, including what people might call Homo ergaster and Homo habilis. And you can then indeed see differences in the kind of things that they ate. And those are the direct evidence, the clues that you find from the fossils where you can start contrasting those two and perhaps start finding clues why one and not the other. Who was eating the meat? Well, the problem is people doing microware talk about pits and grooves and tough food or not tough food, and they are always very careful not to attach too much direct diet consequences. But nevertheless, it looks like that indeed erectus might have ate more of the meat or at least of tough food. Interesting point there is as well is that they conclude that that may well not be a regular diet, but it just may be that in certain extreme circumstances one diverted to another diet, and that may well have been a very selective, may have provided a selective mechanism for
it. Meat as a fallback food?
As fallback food, yes.
Well, I think that raises one of the very interesting questions that came up, particularly with Drs. Lahr and Leakey's talk, in terms of this reliance on meat eating. If you look at, for instance, the ethnographic record of hunter-gatherers, the majority of people don't rely heavily on meat. It's not their primary staple food unless you're in a, you know, Arctic or peri-Arctic environment. So we're talking about an increase in meat eating, but just to what levels is that increase? I mean, these are not obligatory carnivores. So just how important a dietary issue is it that perhaps they're eating more meat? I mean, more can be a very small amount potentially. And the other issue that you touched on that I think is very interesting, that I was actually talking with Catherine Forster from Anatomical Sciences about over the break, is the question of not just what don't we know, but what can't we know in terms of the distribution of our samples. You brought up the East Africa as sort of an artifact of the sample record issue, but also with the timing of out of Africa. Yes, we've got these fossils at 1.8 million years ago, in a variety of areas, but is that a factor of that's what the fossil beds available have, and there is a potential of finding something at 1.9 and it's not there, or is it just that there is a fossiliferous bed available at this particular point in time? So to what extent is our ignorance and our reconstruction of the timing and the patterning of these, the mobility of these hominins, a factor of our samples, or to what extent is it really reflecting reality?
I'd like to say, speak to the first question you put out, and I guess you're probably going to address the
second
question.
One, exactly.
The question of how much meat were they eating. I mean, obviously we can't get at, you know, percentages, but one of the things that I work on, Pleistocene carnivore guilds, and specifically I'm interested in how hominin changes affected the carnivores and how carnivore changes affected the hominins. And prior to 1.8, what hominins do seem to have absolutely no impact on the carnivores. And in fact, it's been my hypothesis, and my work seems to show that carnivores conveniently dying off actually allows hominins to become more carnivorous. But, you know, after 1.8, though, it's a different story. I mean, there's all sorts of other things going on, obviously, besides hominins beginning to eat more meat. But they're obviously eating just enough to impact ecologically on the species around them. So it still may not be a significant component of their diet, but I think that even modern hunter-gatherers today have a significant impact on the carnivores around them. And so it does destabilize the carnivore guild and sort of destabilize the organisms there in general. Now, what relationship that had to, you know, whether they migrated out or not, you know, that's beyond my knowledge, but I'll let you address it.
A point I wanted to make concerning the three lectures we heard and in response to your point, I think we should go back and look at a lot of studies now in modern ecology are looking at long-distance dispersal models for all organisms, not just hominids, and plants as well. And I think dispersal is basically a very basic strategy that all species have, and they're doing it all the time. And the pattern it follows is that it's basically very unsuccessful for the majority of dispersal events, and I don't think we should expect to see it in the record for the majority of the dispersal events. And then if it does happen, first, it's very, very slow. We expect to have recurrent dispersal events in a variety, I'm sure, of cul-de-sacs, as John pointed out, or we would expect that. And if there is then a positive or a successful adaptation to the new environment, then we would expect to see an increase in population and then a further dispersal from that point onward in a very, very fast and increased rate. And this has been tested in many, many species. And I think what we see in hominids, I think we should start, or hope that we should start looking at patterns and try and look at that more and more, but I think the point of what we're not seeing is very important. And if we tie this together with what John was saying, then actually the Levant is a good place where you can see all these unsuccessful or semi-successful, and we probably missed the less successful earlier things, and then later on, the adaptation, maybe vis-a-vis the fire and so on and so forth, maybe we see in GBY, and then the further dispersal. And to make a further point, if we look at the fauna in Ubudia, we can take, let's say, our big Bava the Palaroovis, for example. People tend to use that as an example of, you know, out of Africa, and, you know, mentioned it a lot. But if you look at the quantification, how many actual bones we have maybe nearly only 20 specimens, actual bones of the species out of thousands of bones. So it's very unsuccessful ecologically. You can see it. It only reached Ubudia. It didn't reach further into Europe. It stopped there, and maybe we should start looking at these other taxa as a case of this was unsuccessful. Maybe the Therapithecus was more successful. Some taxa were, some taxa weren't, and try and put the different taxa into a larger, what we call LDD, long-distance dispersal ecological models.
Fred.
Just to be facetious, perhaps, but there's a trend, of course, we've seen it all morning, to say let's try to interpret human evolution in terms of the wider ecological setting. Let's look at all those animals, let's throw plants in and the whole thing. I would actually advocate is that we shouldn't forget to actually at every moment to go back to the original source and where you have the real evidence, the hominin fossils themselves. Why do I say this? As has been quoted this morning, finding an island isolate, as I would interpret it, of Homo erectus on Flores, or finding a chimpanzee in a setting with Homo erectus and Therapithecus as well, was actually not in the paper, but in that same fauna there's the most humongous Friesel size Therapithecus, I've been told. Both of those events would not have been predicted by any ecological setting, because supposedly Homo erectus was too smart already to be isolated on an island, but presto, it happens. Chimpanzees, you know, according to all the models, should not be with those more open environment creatures. So you can see that ultimately the fossils will throw up their own events, and they will, when you do too much modeling, you will just have to start from scratch again. So I want to warn a little bit against all the... It's a very interesting mind game. When I see all the flow charts that people make from one leads to something else, I think, yeah, it's a great mind game to play these things. But one fossil find that is unexpected, as we had several. Chad was another example, which was not supposed to be. Everything is different, and we have to start from scratch again.
Spoken like a true human paleontologist. Yes.
It is clear that humans are part of the community of large mammals, and we had talked. Dr. Legge has talked about the African mammals, but I have to say that in Eurasia, during the Pleistocene boundary, at around 1.8 or 2 million years, there is a very important faunal break. It is detected in the Manisi, and it is also detected in other sites, especially, I don't know exactly what is happening in Asia, but it is especially detected in Europe. We can talk about the sites of the Iberian Peninsula, especially of the Orce sites, Ventamicena, and Fuentenueva, and Barranculeón. There are several species of African origin that are found in the European early Pleistocene. Dr. Legge has talked about Cheropithecus. She also has talked about the presence maybe of Meganterion. I think that Meganterion is an African species in the early Pleistocene of Europe. It's different to the late Pliocene Meganterion in Europe and other areas of Asia. But especially the best known species of African origin in Europe during the early Pleistocene is not Meganterion and is not Cheropithecus. The best known species is Hippopotamus anticus. Never before the Pleistocene, the early Pleistocene, Hippopotamus has been found in Europe. Hippopotamus anticus is a brother species, a sister species of Hippopotamus gorgops. It is found in Ubaidilla. I think it is very well known in all the late Pliocene and early Pleistocene sites of Africa. This Hippopotamus anticus is found in Spain, in everywhere during the early Pleistocene, in Italy, in France. Also, it is found in England, in Germany. It is found in all the Balkan Peninsula, in Turkey. And the eastern site where Hippopotamus is found during the early Pleistocene is in Georgia. It's at the site of Akalkalaki, dated in the early Pleistocene, and it is not clear what is the age. Hippopotamus anticus is two times bigger, larger than the extant Hippopotamus amphibious. As the name Hippopotamus amphibious says, it is an amphibious species. But our later studies of the Hippopotamus anticus from the site of Ventamicena says that Hippopotamus anticus was not amphibious. Probably it was an aquatic species. Why? Because it only was eating aquatic plants. We had done the study of the oligoelements there, and this species was eating plants that didn't fix the nitrogen 2. And the nitrogen 15 is bigger than in the large carnivores, especially in the saber-toothed tigers. This is very important because hippopotamus are present in all the early Pleistocene sites in Africa where hominids are present. And in this area, in Europe and the Caucasian region or the Middle East, the only one site where hippopotamus is not present is the Manisi. But when you find lithic artifacts in Europe during the early Pleistocene, everywhere, there are hippopotamus. It means that probably hominids were very close to the water resources, and also hippopotamus cannot survive in the temperatures when they are very, very low. Hippos need a lot of water, and probably this dispersal of hominids outside Africa were related especially with the water resources, and these hippopotamus are not found in Asia. The eastern side is Akalkalaki, because probably they could not cross these areas of Central Asia without water resources. Hippos are not found also in Southern Asia, in India or in other or in Southeast Asia. Why? Probably they were in competence with the local exoprotodon, the other model of hippos. But in any cases, hippos revealed a very important ecological characteristics, probably for hominids. Also, the behavior about the carnivore behavior, we have talked about a lot of times, and during the early Pleistocene in Eurasia, there is the large hyena Pachycrocuta brevirostris, which is a very important event in the faunal assemblages. Pachycrocuta brevirostris is not the same hyena, it's different to other hyenas we know. We think that it was especially a super scavenger. It was not a cursorial, because the study of their legs means that they were very short. They were very they could use this the force to destroy the carcasses, but they were not able to run behind the prey, and probably they were they compete with other carnivores for the prey. Exclusively, they were within that they were exclusively scavengers. In the sites of Orce, at the site of Fuentenova III, we have documented lately the direct competence in between Pachycrocuta brevirostris and hominids, because we had found around one elephant, one Mammutus meridionalis, the mostly complete skeleton of elephant, the presence of coprolites, the presence of lytic artifacts around the elephant, and this means that they were in a direct competition, and this probably was different to the competition in Eastern Africa or maybe in South African sites, because Pachycrocuta brevirostris is a hyena larger than 100 kilograms, mostly the double of the crocutas. It is found in Europe from Spain until China and in Southeast Asia in Java. It is also found. It is found from 1.82 million years old until approximately 900 years old. Dr. Ligi has told that Crocuta was an African immigrant into Europe or into Eurasia. Well, the only one site outside Africa where Crocuta clearly has been documented during the early Pleistocene, older than 1 million years, is at the site of Ubeidilla. It is not present in any other site of Eurasia. It was cited in other sites, but for example in Akalkalaki in Georgia. But this is Pachycrocuta, it's not Crocuta. It's a question of the determination. Crocuta is an scavenger and hunter hyena. It's different, its behavior, to the behavior of Pachycrocuta. And hominids had a very big competence in Eurasia, and this competence was different in Africa at that moment. Also, Crocuta is found in Ubeidilla together with Acheulean lytic artifacts. When you, in other sites of Eurasia, when you find Pachycrocuta, it is found together with Olduvan lytic artifacts. Well, I think that we have to take in, we think that the conditions in Eurasia were totally different than the conditions were in Africa during the early Pleistocene, and the adaptation of hominids to survive in Eurasia has to be studied better than we know at this moment.
Thank you very much. Comments or responses? Margaret.
I think we'd agree that Eurasia and Africa have very different ecological situations. I think we'd agree that Africa and Eurasia have very different ecological situations, but I think one of the problems with Pachycrocuta is that it's a genus that's in severe need of revision. I think people are calling it Pachycrocuta brevirostris. The Pachycrocuta you see in eastern Africa, for example, is not much larger than a spotted hyena, and yet it gets outside into Eurasia and just does something insane. And I think we don't really fully understand it well enough. I realize that's the large part of our differences. Most everything. I mean, it's, you know, I agree that we just have no clue what's going on with Crocuta, and that's something that I've been trying to work on. I mean, it's Crocuta is a bit of a pain, but with Pachycrocuta, I think that, and for me, it is hard to imagine something that large that's just a scavenger. That's another discussion. The other thing I wanted to ask was, are you positing a special ecological relationship between hominids and hippos then in Eurasia, or are you just talking about the water corridors?
Well, maybe there are some ecological relationships between hippos and hominids. If hippos are exclusively aquatic, they are easier to be hunted than if they are terrestrial. Yeah? For hominids, if they are in Africa, all the sites during the early Pleistocene, you can find, especially, I have been working in Buya in Eritrea, and the dominant fauna are hippos and crocodiles. And most of these hippos and crocodiles have been eaten by hominids. We are documenting similar behavior in the Orce area, in the sites of Fuentenueva and Barranco León. Maybe there is something in relation, and not only the environment.
Fred, you'd want to comment?
Very, very brief comment. When I hear about dispersal of hippos, then I think it really shows hippos with a long generation span, and of course not terribly cursorial. We think quite often in human evolution, oh, well, only with Homo erectus, when we got long legs and we become long-distance runners, we can only get out of Africa. We really have to have that. And it shows, you know, if you're a hippo, you happily disperse out of Africa, and you do it with the limbs that you have.
Are you suggesting aquatic routes for out of Africa?
Not really, but...
Thank you. Any other comments before we open it up to people in the audience? Anything else you can think of? All right. I just happened to see Dr. Delson's hand shoot up there.
He's not sitting in the front row.
If you would just, microphone will come to you.
Fred just mentioned something that I was going to discuss briefly, which is the question of dispersal and speed of dispersal. John Shea also mentioned the idea that it's somewhat unexpected that human remains, including archaeological residues, are of closely similar age in the Levant, at Dmanisi, and in Java, which suggests especially rapid transit. Maybe the Levant Transit Authority was very successful after all. But this is a subject that's long been discussed by mammalian paleontologists. Consider a troop of baboons, a herd of horses, or a group of early humans. And if they disperse in all directions from a given area in search of food or just because the population size is increasing at the rate of 1 kilometer a year, they can get from East Africa to Java in less than 20,000 years. A time period that we cannot see in the fossil record at 2 million years ago. It's instantaneous. But in fact, they're going awfully slowly, 1 kilometer a year. They could walk that distance in 1 year. In fact, it took them a significant length of time, whatever the length of their legs, and whatever type of animal, be it a hippo or a human, dispersal can be instantaneous to a paleontologist 2 million years after the fact when it wasn't then.
I don't think I detected a question in that comment, but we can try again. Anyone else in the back, please?
No.
Okay. Can you hear me? Okay. I had my question is sort of basic in general. If as we see the evidence for the earliest stone tools is at about 2.6 million years, and especially the first two speakers have made a strong link between stone tools and the origins of carnivory and this dispersal. Why do we not see the dispersal? Why do we not see the dispersal until 1.8 million years?
Well, I don't think I need to repeat that question. Would someone want to tackle it? One of the speakers this morning or panelists? Maybe we should give the speakers this morning the first shot. John, me, anybody want to? Yes. Here's a wait for the
trick is these are these rock star microphones. You really have to put them right next to your lips. I'm going to respond with a comment about the stone tools. And this is one of these myths. That's my area of expertise. I'm a paleolithic rockhead. There's a long-established myth in archaeology that the stone tools are primarily butchery tools, and that's because they often are found with animal remains. Okay, fine. They're also often found with nothing at all. So the question of whether there's a tight correlation between the production of stone tools and butchery is potentially a case of a false positive result. We have high visibility sites with stone tools and animal remains. We have very few sites where we have the remains of the stone tools together with vegetal material, like Gesher Benatia Cove or Colombo Falls and other places. It's worth keeping in mind that the stone tools may not be registering changes in butchery or changes in predation. They may equally well be monitoring changes in production of wooden artifacts. So we know so little about the stone tools. They're an imperfect guideline to what's going on behaviorally. Potentially they may inform us, potentially not. We need to know more about the factors that structure the production of stone tools.
Thanks, John. Anyone else? Please.
Going back to basically how animals disperse, you definitely need a corridor, and that has to be climatically oriented to some extent. And as John pointed out, there are a few ways they could have dispersed, but we have to correlate it with the climate and the grasslands and the Sahara and whatnot, and it can be discussed further, but definitely maybe at 2.5, even if they tried, if the barriers would not have allowed them to go through, that would have been impossible. They may have tried, and, you know, we have no evidence for it.
Can panelists ask questions?
Certainly.
Yeah. So I have a question actually for the panel and all the speakers. To what extent should we look at this 1.8 immigration as a few elite African species emerging through a corridor, or an entire African ecosystem moving in and displacing a Eurasian, previously existing Eurasian ecosystem, or something in between? Do we have a clear picture?
I think we all have different opinions.
In the Levantine corridor, in the sites of Vidilla or Gesher Benot Jacob, you can find a mixed fauna of Eurasian origin or African origin.
So it's not a complete African egress. But what about the other extreme? Is it just a few elite African species that are penetrating the Eurasian population? Is that the way
we should look at? Only few but significant species penetrated into the Eurasia.
I would like to add to it, if you go back to what Benvenuto said about the hippos.
Speak to the mic.
Sorry. If you go back to what Benvenuto said about the hippos, we can see in Ubidia we have two species of hippos. We have the Gorgops, which is specifically East African, very typical, and we have the modified, evolved, actually endemic, as John said, Hippopotamus behemoth. So that species would have had to, let's say, dispersed earlier, in which have given it enough time to have evolved into be an endemic species from whatever it came from, maybe a Gorgops previously, but before 1.6, it had to have come somewhere around the two, maybe the Arak al-Akhmar, so on. I'm just totally improvising right now. But so we have some, again, a few waves, but so you have another specific taxa that came, but that would tie in.
Thank you.
Only few species penetrated into Eurasia, and only few species penetrated into Africa. For example, into Africa penetrated the lycaons, the painted dogs, the hunting painted dogs, which is a very social species, a carnivore social species, and it's very important in the early Pleistocene of Africa.
Yes, Richard.
Thank you. I'd like to put a question to Fred, I think. You spoke with some assurance and authority on there being Homo habilis and Homo erectus overlapping with each other for close to half a million years. This, in your comment, you said from 2 to 1.5, suggesting two Homo species overlapping consistently in Africa. I want to focus on Asia, as I said earlier. How many species of hominid have you got outside Africa from whatever the date of their first appearance?
Species of hominid?
Hominid, or hominin, if you people
hominid,
prefer.
Whatever, yes. Altogether.
Altogether at one time, one after each other. How many species are you recognizing out of Africa?
Out of Africa altogether. Homo erectus, undoubtedly. I would probably cautiously agree with Homo sapiens, I guess. Homo floresiensis, I was going to say, so I will vote for that. Then you end up with this awkward... I would indeed classify Neanderthals as a separate species, so that's... where are we, three?
Four of you.
Four? Am I now? So we're left with this, and I wasn't there, so that was the discussion of the previous workshop. You end up with this awkward middle group that in at least in Europe clearly manifests itself as pre-Neanderthal. Steinheim, Simon Los Huesos. Exactly what's going on in China, particularly in that respect, is very complicated. So I'm kind of sitting there on the fence. So I end up with four and then a little tail end that I'm not so sure what to do with. But actually, that is not a weakness. I always emphasize that to journalists to say, you know nothing. But I think as we know, we get an increasingly perfect fossil record for human evolution. Sounds weird in this context perhaps to say that, but I honestly, if you compare it with other mammals, I honestly believe that. And of course, as you get a better fossil record, the boundaries will be blurred, and we will, if we had a perfect fossil record, we were at a loss to name species because you can't, because they all link up through time eventually.
Okay, we have four on the table. There are other paleontologists in the audience. You want to have a go at that? How about somebody's written a book on Homo erectus? Philip?
I'd certainly like to add one more species to the list. That would be Homo heidelbergensis.
That's the easy catch for that mid group. That's true.
Anyone else want to comment on that question?
Eric?
I'd prefer to suggest that what we normally call heidelbergensis in Europe is actually early Neanderthalensis, but what I'm worried about is more the Ciprano, TD6, and possibly connections to northern Africa as an African species that got into Europe in between this first dispersal and later dispersals. So I'd say five in Europe or Eurasia. I don't know about Africa, about China. I don't see anything that's really different there, but it's tricky. But rather than talking about the middle Pleistocene, or the later middle Pleistocene in Europe as heidelbergensis compared to Neanderthals, I'd rather focus on the earliest representatives in Europe, which don't look like the Maurer, Boxgrove, Petralina, Bilsingsleben, Sima group.
Thank you, Eric. Comments? Other questions from the audience?
I'm surprised that you include Boxgrove in there. How can you compare what a tibia looks like compared to a set of skulls?
Yes.
Yeah, just a question on meat eating versus vegetable eating, carnivores versus herbivores, as far as hominids go. In the course of your human life, being a vegetarian is no disadvantage as to your health versus being a meat eater. But over a period of time, we've heard something earlier where this carnivore behavior, this increase in protein, leads to larger brains. In that case, if in fact hominids for a very long period of time were vegetarians, is that a disadvantage to brain growth?
Well, I think to a certain extent it depends on what you consider advantageous versus disadvantageous. Having a bigger brain is not necessarily an automatic plus. There is, as I understand it, some controversy about not just the origins of meat eating. Some people posit that there were, reasonable amounts of meat eating on the Australopithecines, but also the extent to which they're meat eating now and potentially the impacts of different forms of food preparation. Richard Wrangham has brought forth the idea that it has more to do with cooking, which is a whole other can of worms. Not literally.
Have some.
culinary joys. But I think there are very good studies about the biological implications of eating meat in terms of it's a concentrated form of energy in comparison with a lot of other foods. So it does change things, certainly. And depending on how much you're eating, it can change things more or less profoundly, both for you and, as Margaret pointed out, for the surrounding communities. But I don't, this is why I asked the question, is I don't think it's necessarily a clear-cut situation in terms we know what, A, exactly the repercussions are going to be, B, exactly how much they're doing, or any of that. So I think it's very much something that requires more information.
Sure, please.
I think when we think of vegetarians today, we also have to keep in mind that they have to eat certain foods in certain ratios. I mean, you look at vegetarians in Mexico, you know, a certain ratio of corn and beans to maintain the proper amino acids. So you can't just randomly eat vegetation without a certain percentage to it. And you were talking about, you know, the disadvantages of having a large brain. I mean, it makes childbirth, it makes walking more difficult. I mean, there are quite a lot of disadvantages. So it's a system of trade-offs, and I think that's, you know, what evolution ultimately always is. You trade one thing for another, something that's more useful for your new environment. You know, and if it's slightly increasing, and I agree, we have no clue how much carnivory there was, what percentage of the diet it was. It just seems enough that it was enough to tip the balance within the environment.
Marta, you have.
Yes, I just wanted to make a small comment, because both in the previous comment about carnivory, that carnivory, if it evolved with stone tools 2.5 million years ago, why didn't they leave? And if carnivory leads to brain enlargement, like it was said right now, and I'm very sorry, apologize if I wasn't clear. I don't think that carnivory makes them leave. I think it allowed them to leave. You needed something else at some point that triggered that dispersal. They could do it because they were eating more meat. In the same way that carnivory does not lead to brain enlargement, otherwise lions would have giant brains. I mean, it allows, or it allowed in our lineage, for brain enlargement. So it's different. It's a condition, not a cause.
Thank you. Other questions or comments from the audience? Yes, please.
It strikes me that with paleo diet work, you could figure out the percentage of carnivory that they're enjoying. And I have to ask the question as to why some of these fossils haven't been studied to look at the paleo diet implications.
Was that a question or a challenge? I'll let other speakers answer that question. I certainly have my opinion.
Probably hominids in Eurasia were more carnivores than in Africa, because in Eurasia during the seasonal climate, during winters, what they can eat. Probably during winters, they only could survive if they were carnivores, more still carnivores than in Africa. In Africa, they can eat vegetables during all the year, but in Eurasia, in the middle latitudes, this was more difficult, and probably they were more carnivores than in the than in Africa.
I also think Fred alluded to this earlier. Some of the methods, like microware, are rather blunt instruments when you're trying to do percentages. They tell you something about what they ate, but maybe what they ate last. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are isotopic data, but
they're not easy to use either. Yeah. Studies are great when they're feasible, but they're frequently not feasible, and then you have problems of what the surrounding matrix is like and how much you have leaching in. It's not something where you can just plug in and get a nice tidy set of answers.
Yes, Eric, one more.
Yeah. We are discussing here what's considered as the first African exodus. But Meev mentioned earlier, as a throwaway in one of her slides, the idea that during the Miocene, all connections of catarrhines were from Africa out into Eurasia. In fact, let's not forget that it's been suggested somewhat independently by paleontologists and geneticists that perhaps the African ape plus human lineage and the orang lineage differentiated in Eurasia from a Dryopithecus-like ancestor, and then what we call the African lineage may have returned into Africa at 9 or 10 million years ago. This is very much up in the air, but it's still, there is value to this hypothesis. And also, it leads me to ask, since you'd like questions, whether entries from Eurasia into Africa of associated faunal elements might also have been important in relationship to the question that's being discussed here, that is directly the resulting exodus of humans from Africa.
Well, regarding the first thing, I would automatically say, well, you know, if you go far enough back in time, then you can endlessly argue where your what the original continent or the original part was. So I think we really talk about hominin evolution here. So what's happening in the Miocene apes is another thing. I can't really comment on the other thing, except that I can add a question to that, perhaps. That's, I think we should try to struggle with at least a bit. What is that really hard evidence against the scenario of hominins leaving Africa, let's say at 2.4, hanging around in West Asia, eventually leading to things like the Munisi and Homo erectus, which, you know, the first occurrence of Homo erectus in Africa is near identical in resolution, if you take that into account, near identical to what you indeed do find in Southeast Asia and the Munisi. So that there was already a presence outside Africa for a while, and that there was perhaps, so that the erectus that you see in Africa is a migration back into Africa rather than out of Africa. I mean, instinctively we all say, oh, what a nonsense, but what is the real hard evidence? Are there sites, are there really great sites at 2.3, 2.4, 2.2 in East Asia where you can say, well, if they were around, they should have been here. We have this beautiful fauna. Or is it just, again, an artifact of the fact that we just don't have the sites to look at it?
All right, yes, Mark.
Just a little comment. There is a beautiful, and probably the richest paleontological site in North Africa, dated to 2.3, 2.4, and it doesn't have any tools, any hominins, anything. There's another one dated to around 2, Waimbusherit, and it doesn't either. So the first evidence is 1.8 at Ain Hanesh. So it's in North Africa, it's very clear.
Anything else this morning? Get it off your chest now, come on. Richard, I think.
I just want the general audience to hear this. I mean, I think the panelists, particularly Fred, have been talking with such specificity about 1.8 and 2 million. There are people, and I think this will come out in the next few days, who are not at all persuaded that there is any hominid out of Africa older than 1.7. Now, this is a very significant point, because if it is really only 1.7, then a lot of the other arguments that are taken on faith fall apart very quickly. And I think one of the challenges of the next few days will be to agree on what is, as you say, real evidence, as opposed to what we would like there to be as real evidence. And at the moment, you say, what's wrong with hominids at 2.4 out of Africa, or 1.8, or 2.2? What's wrong with it is there aren't any. When there are, that's a different issue, but we can only deal with what we have, not what we hope. And I'm simply worried that there is a general principle of using numbers without going back to the source. And a lot of the dates that are being used in this out of Africa discussion, if you go back to the original publications, are couched in around or nearly or approximate with an error bar. And we're pushing the age back of hominids without necessarily having any basis of doing so. I also would like to put on record that while fossils are hard to find, lithic material is generally much easier to find. And there are many areas of the world, the old world, where there are good deposits with other fossils, maybe no hominids, but people have been looking for artifacts for a long time, and they're significant in their absence. And I think that is also telling, if indeed that's relevant to our story. The final point I want to make, and I think it's important to come back to what Kathy alluded to, hunter-gatherers today are living in very marginal areas, and meat is not necessarily a very important part of their diet. But if you ask them, would you prefer a tuber to a piece of steak, if both were equally available, I think they'd go for a piece of steak. And I think we've got to remember that 2 million years ago, 1.5 million years ago, or somewhere between, there was probably a great deal more wildlife associated with hominids, and there was probably a lot less fear between the hominids and the wildlife than is today, and it'd be much easier to get hold of. And I think we've got to be very careful when suggesting that because hunter-gatherers don't eat a lot of meat today, it's probably because it's very difficult, and it may have been very easy. And I just want to throw that out, and I take the point that was made about Eurasia, where the winters would have required a far higher dependence on carnivory than in some of the tropical ecosystems that early hominids lived in.
Thank you, Richard. It seems appropriate to let Richard have the last word this morning, and why don't we pursue our own dietary pursuits for a while. Lunch is served just outside the door.
Okay. Well, welcome back from the break. We're starting with the talks again here.
So today we have international interdisciplinary research group, and it will take all my lecture if I will give your names, all names and all universities which are participants of this group. So you can see the site where actually we have excavations, and after 83 we had first stone tools, 84, and now it's large, not large I would say, this is as for archaeological maybe scale, quite small excavations, but I would say from the other way quite productive. So you can see this general geology. Everywhere you have lava flow. This only place where you have below lava you have, no, it doesn't work. This is a near Dmanisi site where you can have old soils, but usually lava flow are below lava flow, we already have tertiary sediments, Cretaceous sediments, but above the lava flow everywhere, which dates 1.85, we have now around 3-4 meters, this is 4 meters is maximum, sediments. So this is the different stages of Dmanisi. You can see there we can use at least 6 main stages of the paleotopography and, let's say, sedimentological history. Not to boring you for all details, I would say, we can see very clearly dates. We have 1.85, which is the lower part of the, which is the basalt lava flow, and we have 1.82 from the volcanic ashes, you see what we have. And also we have the paleomagnetic studies, and what I can say very clear today that what we have below, everything which is the below calcareous horizon, it's a very rapid sedimentation. And everyone who saw the Dmanisi and preservation of the fossils, I think they will agree that all the fossils were buried very quickly. So this is the view. You can see everywhere the lava flow, which is very fresh, and above it we have the sediments. So all different integrated methodology shows that we have dates around between 1.7 and 1.8 million. So this is integration, of course, the radiometric. All,
which?
I think the top one.
Oh, that's, thank you. We have radiometric, paleomagnetic, and also now we have very good record of micro mammals, you know, let's say rodents also. Everything shows, the biostratigraphic arguments also, everything shows that we are in this time range. So one of the attraction, I would say, trove in Dmanisi, it's a faunal remains. And today we can say we almost 40 species we have today. It's a huge diversity and also a big gift for us to study really whole branch and whole environment with, you can see, just general groups. But Bienvenido Martinez Navarro, who is one of the team members and who is today here, we can think we can discuss later also details of how diverse the Manisi fauna was. You can see also the preservation. This is one of the skull of the rhinoceros. You can see ostriches, you can see giraffes. We have three skulls of the Canis etruscus, one of the earliest wolves in Eurasia, in Europe. This is elephants. This is gazelles. The bovids, it's very interesting work now, PhD thesis of about bovids of Dmanisi. It shows that we have at least 7-8 species of bovids in Dmanisi. This is rhinoceros. And saber-toothed cats, we have both group, megantarians and homotarians. And carnivore guild is also one of the very interesting setting, important group in Dmanisi, which shows we have different groups of carnivores like flesh meat eaters, as saber-toothed cats, and also we have big Panthera gombasoegensis, and also we have two groups of crocutas. So, but we have also stone tools, not only faunal remains, and maybe we are also getting traces of cut marks on the bones. So, what is this Dmanisi? Importance of Dmanisi, one of the importance is also this. We have the association of stone tools and fauna. And I will remind you, before Dmanisi finds, this prevailing view was that first humans out of Africa should have sophisticated stone tools, let's say Aeschylean stone tools, when they have already symmetry and more developed technology. But if you will take whole Dmanisi collection, you will never find any bifaces, and they all belong to the let's say old one, or let's say or use modern industry. And it's interesting that if you will compare this, I put specially here, there are two Dmanisi stone tools, and they are another stone tools more developed from the region. So let's say these humans had opportunity to use other raw material also. They were doing these stone tools, and all them are primitive stone tools, and not yet any Aeschylean stone tools were developed. So we can, and we did some experimental studies, we did petrographic studies, and everything shows that in Dmanisi we have most primitive stone industry. So this is some kind of presentation, what was the idea in 91, who should be Dmanisi people? Let's say people who left West Africa, and they should be as clever as Pansor de Rodin to have, let's say, brain capacity, and they should be maybe already developed hunter like Chukwutian. So in 91, the prevailing view was, will remind you that the first humans who left Africa should be quite developed, either mentally and also technologically. We saw that technologically it's not very true. Now we will see how it was anatomically. So this is a picture, also a historical picture, in 91, and you can see the reaction after the find of this stone tool. It's the first human jaw. This is a reaction in 91 when this was first presented in Frankfurt, this finding of, And I just wanted to say, here are some students also, to say that who are these people. There is Clark Howell, and Milford Wolpoff, but also this is a Professor Leo Gabunier, who is one of the, I would say, pioneer of research in Georgia. And I would say it would be impossible to have success of Dmanisi without him. And unfortunately, he left us, but you see his works, and I'm happy that it's continuous. Tradition, which is very important always for science, and this is, I would say, fundament where we can develop future. So this was the reaction in 91 when first human jaw was found. See, most of you, I'm sure, know this story. This is also one kind, maybe part of story of science already. But I just simply will remind you what was the main discussion about this jaw. This was, what is more important, to have more archaic architecture, morphology general, or the reduction of third molar, what you can see here. This is a progressive features, and Manisi hominids are very late Homo erectus. Or, but simply to say, in 91 was very hard to imagine that you could have human record out of Africa, particularly in Georgia, still with Georgia, Russian Georgia, to have a human fossil so old and, let's say, also so primitive, which could belong to the early African homos. But then we had a chance to find first skull, then second skull, which this is the first skull, which was found in 99. When I was preparing this lecture, I was thinking how to present human fossils, and I decided to present it on the chronological order of findings, because maybe today it's a more appropriate way to present fossils than to group, because as I told you, we have today more questions than answers. So I will just follow the story when was how the chronologically we were finding hominids. So it's a 99 skull, this first skull, then same year another skull which was, let's say, even more well preserved. It's a smaller. There is some discussion about this skull of the deformation, but now we made more reconstruction of this deformation, and you will see it fits well the general picture. You can see the different features, but we can finally then summarize, and tomorrow with the talk with Philip Reitmeier, we can discuss all details of anatomy. But you see, the first feeling what was, and I think for everyone, is they are very small. You can see how small they are in comparison with modern humans. But generally, this is one of the first real features of the Manisi hominids. They are small. And what are the general summary? I will speak a little bit later. So they say next year was this find of, which is still big headache. This is a big jaw, and some of my colleagues, one asked me, she's here, that, are you sure this is Homo? And one of my colleague asked me, you should put it back in ground. He's also here, but I don't know about his opinion today. So this was this jaw, the first feelings, what very seriously to say, that it's very different from others. But in reality, I'm sure both of them, if we will see, it's how different is the fourth, the first jaw. This is also preservation and size, allometry. And anyway, so let's let it as a question. Is it, if some people there like to have a new species, this is here, if we will stay with one definition of Homo erectus and it will fit in general in group of the Manisi, this is another way. So just simply to say, this jaw was a headache, still headache, but you see, we need skull, and who knows, maybe then we will solve this problem. Like, so then the next year, this is the 2700 when we found this teenager, then with a jaw, which is very well preserved, and which has very interesting features also. It's that it has very small brain capacity, around 600 cc. And if we will use it for summary of these skulls, we can say that old Manisi hominids share the common architect, common morphology. They are small, their endocranial volume is 650 cubic centimeter. And you can see here already first, maybe not dominant, but features which are the Manisi makes close resemblance to early Homo from Africa. But in more aspects, the Manisi morphology resembles to Homo erectus, and this is cranial profile, this is frontal sagittal cleaning, proportion of midwall, and etc. So this is a comparison to Manisi with early Africa. This is collection for 2003, and usually the first question was how many species and how they are different. But if we will put all this Frankfurt horizontal same way, you can see there is not a big difference, almost no difference. And after reconstruction, you will see this skull also fits very well this general picture. So this just to have the idea about size and Neanderthal, then modern human and Dmanisi. So this is another summary of these Dmanisi characters, cranial and mandibular characters. You can see this just, for example, here, brain capacity generally, and this Homo erectus shared capacities, characters. So, but we were more waiting for to find postcranial bones, but you see, this was quite different when we found this skull. This is 2003, then we are finding, you can see this block, and we got another skull. So this is a 2003 discoveries when we have skull and then jaw. You can see what is the result, final result. So which also fits well this previous picture, but it has, you can see, it has no teeth. This is a now I think most of you know about this skull, which is completely edentulous, toothless hominid. You can see we made the reconstruction of all three skulls, four skulls, three, let's say, with face, and they are fitting quite well in one way. So this is a place also how it was found, and you can see all hominids, this is a first find. And here you have 270, 2735, 390, 344, this toothless hominid, and this 2600. And all they are coming from this level, which we can say it's very close to 1.8 million. So this is what we had, these four skulls together. And you can see the also general dimensions, and you can see that how close all of them are. Only 2600 mandible is out of this. So to summarize, we can say today for sure that Dmanisi hominids represent first immigrants from Africa from whom Asian branch of Homo erectus probably could be derived. Anyway, I would say that Dmanisi is one of the best candidate, we can say that, to be ancestor of Homo erectus, whatever we will call it. So either we are here, if we will use more big, more bushy taxonomy, or if we're in the linear stage, we are also between habilis and erectus in this way. So it's up to taste what we will choose. So this is different. So to summarize, we can say very clearly to answer the questions. When humans left Africa, you can see that Dmanisi makes much elder than we thought. So, and this is at least 1.75. Or, you see, and also I'm not sure even we are very lucky and we got all these jackpots, I'm not sure we found exactly first immigrants. It's very hard to imagine that all this way from Africa to Georgia, they were first and they exactly died in this place. So it can be, it's not definitely not excluded. It could be earlier records. So who left Africa? You see, this is the Dmanisi hominins are the first found outside of Africa, shows the clear affinities to early African Homo. And they are primitive and small-brained, but it was before the Homo florensis. But anyway, the Dmanisi population could be founder of generally Homo erectus. So, and why humans left Africa? See, I can say only that Dmanisi shows that they didn't acquire large brain and sophisticated stone tools. The answers are still to come, either during this symposium, but I don't think it's better to postpone it for the next symposium to get. So Dmanisi is quite different if we'll make reconstruction from the what was previously thought. But you see, we can guess that these humans should have not only heads, they should have body, right? So, and another important, I would say, for aim is our goal is to find postcranial bones. And you can see during these excavations, it's a good sign that it means that it was something important. So we're starting to get human bones, and you can see what a nice femur which was found. So the problem is now, and chance, this is the artificial reconstruction of National Geographic, of a picture of the Dmanisi postcranials. This is the question is, which I can say very clearly today, we don't know about proportions in Dmanisi. We are working on it, and that's why it was a little bit early today to speak about details. We have more individuals than we thought, and it needs real serious work to be sure which postcranial belongs to which specimen. So this is the only reason, but I promise you, you will hear soon the results of this analysis. So maybe we are on the way to have another complete skeleton like Nariokotome Boy. So, and we will have not only faces, we will have also also body. So it's just reconstruction. And just to come back to this fourth skull, what was, we were talking that it fits anatomically very well in whole this picture. Also it fits, it shows also some differences that this is, I would say, one of the earliest, if not earliest, toothless hominin ever found completely. What should be interpretation, what it brings, you know? I told you that Dmanisi brought a new view, image of the prehistory. Also, it shows that how Georgia was attractive for the first humans to come. And also, this is a reconstruction. And also, this skull brings a new evidence which will be helpful for another image of Dmanisi and Georgia. And I will say why, what I wanted to say. So this is some edentulous lemurs. This is a, thanks for to Susan Anton, this is one of the modern humans when they have completely toothless, the result. And here is only example, which at least I know, about completely toothless sheep. So we can say that it's a very rare to have complete toothless hominids in that time period, which left, who lost whole teeth during the life. Only one teeth was preserved. You can see all the sockets. So what could be interpretation of it? You know, one could be this man was very tough man and was real macho, and he was leader, but in Georgia there are so many machos and leaders, I think it's better to make this interpretation that this was first maybe taking first care, and this was first compassion. So very seriously to say this, we propose this idea, maybe we have something more than just simply toothless hominids, and this is maybe more different social relationship what could be seen before. Anyway, I think this brings a good image that this was not only attractive country, that here were nice people, right? So this is a way, but you see this is it was the last discovery, but you see Dmanisi has another big potential, what I would say. This is bringing new questions and also giving us chance really to study population. To study population and to be a little bit more and more in details. So this is behavior, way of life. But you see, each year it brings a new surprises. And last surprise was we were waiting in other postcranials and we found this, which was very good present. It was found on my birthday. So, and now I hope that it will be another opportunity to answer on these questions what we had before. So thank you very much, and I hope we will have chance to talk more, and next time I will present more details and more new discoveries to discuss these issues, who, when, and why left Africa. Thank you.
All right, well, our next speaker will be Dr. Susan Anton, who is Associate Professor of Anthropology at NYU. And she'll be talking today about the early hominins of Southeast Asia, history and controversy.
Perfect, thank you. Okay, well, Dotto is always an incredibly hard act to follow, so I will do my best to continue our journey. My job today is to tell the tale of a band of scrappy hominins as they move to the furthest extent of their realm, the what today is the island of Java. And I'm going to take Richard very literally in terms of trying to tell you where we have controversies, where I'm sort of fudging over, and where I actually have some solid data. I hope by the end of this you will have an idea of who they were that went into island Southeast Asia, why they moved, when they moved, at what date they moved, and perhaps what happened a bit after they got to island Southeast Asia. But those are pretty bold things to have you come away with, and in truth, every single one of those questions is greatly contested, and I'm sure even this image that is up on the board is sending some of my colleagues into slight paroxysms as I speak. So what I'm actually going to do is give you my read on the thread of the evidence that I find most compelling, to try to point up where there are controversies, to hopefully give you by the end of today a kind of better idea, better armament for drawing your own conclusions, and probably really what I will have done is given you some armature for drawing my conclusions, and then I will go with my conclusions and argue with my colleagues over the next few days. So let's start our journey, and at the beginning of this journey is a good point to point out that the original journey into what is today island Southeast Asia was in fact an overland journey. We have off of what we now know today as mainland Asia, a very shallow continental shelf, so that as sea levels drop during glacial periods, this area is exposed and you can have a land bridge, and so you can walk out onto the island of Java. So we're not talking about a water dispersal, we're talking about an overland dispersal. And we have periods of time beginning around 2.5 million years ago where we have a land bridge connection. So if you look at this red line, everything to this side of the red line, anytime we get a little dip in our oxygen isotope signatures, that tells us that we had some kind of a land bridge connection. And those were good times for hominids to be able to walk or at least wade into island Southeast Asia, as well as other land mammals. And then you'll also notice that there would be periods of isolation where the island would be, in fact, an island, and presumably Homo erectus, without watercraft, we could argue about that too, would be isolated as well. So there would be these opportunities for ebbs and flows between the genetics of the populations. Okay, another point to make about the hominins in island Southeast Asia is that unlike the hominins that Dotto was just talking about at Dimonisi, these hominins have been known for a really long time. So the very first fossil hominins to be found on the island of Java were found in the 1890s. So we've known about fossil hominins in Indonesia for over 100 years. That's a long time. We've known about them so long that when they were first discovered there, they were only the second kind of hominid to have been found, the others being Neanderthals. And as a result, they were the most primitive of the hominids that we then knew, even though pretty big brain sizes at about 1,000 cc's. They were very, very primitive, and in fact, the argument about these early hominids was, in fact, whether they were hominids at all. So that the first discoverers of these, Eugene Dubois, who found the type specimen, or whose group found the type specimen at Trinil, like any good discoverer of a fossil hominid, he placed his hominid straight on the line to Homo sapiens. But nearly, and that applies to no one in this room. No one in this room. Every other discoverer of fossil hominins. straight on the line to modern humans, but most everyone else at the time put it off the line to humans, and in fact, very many argued that it was some kind of an ape. So the implication for hominids in Indonesia was not originally very obvious to the dispersal from Africa because we didn't even have hominids in Africa at that time. It was not even very obvious what their importance was to human evolution because it wasn't even clear that they were on the line to humans. That view, of course, rapidly changed so that you had in the 1920s and the 1930s a whole series of skulls. There were some teeth that were found earlier, a whole series of skulls that were discovered in China, assigned, note, to a different genus, but clearly hominids. And in the early 1930s, a whole series of skulls that were found back in Java in some high river terraces that were assigned to yet another genus because they had relatively big brains. And at Perning in 1936, the Mojokerto child was discovered, again assigned to Homo, but to a different species because it had a pretty round vault. And at the San Juan Dome in the late 30s, a whole series of fossils, not all of which are shown here, that were assigned to a couple of different genera of hominids. So by the late 1930s, this idea that there were, in fact, hominids in island Southeast Asia was fairly well established. And these hominids in Java and also in China were assigned to four separate genera of hominids. They were all considered hominids, but they were assigned to four separate genera. Now, if you look just at the Javanese material, they were assigned to at least three separate genera, even though if you were to read closely Weidenreich's writings, von Königswald's writings, they recognized that they were probably part of one sort of extended lineage. Still, the tradition of the time was to assign things that looked very different to very different genera, and as the sort of modern synthesis became part of paleoanthropology, these similarities between all of those genera were synonymized into what we now know today as Homo erectus. And that's fairly well where they have stayed since then. Okay. So if we look at sort of the history of cranial finds and we think about this first period of discovery of Homo erectus, and this is a chart we're going to be seeing periodically throughout the talk, so let me just orient you here. This is discovery date by decade along the x-axis. This is what I ascribe as their geological ages, and I'm sure that we'll argue about this, too, over the next few days. The little legend on the bottom tells you whereabouts they were found: Java, China, Africa, and more recently, Georgia. So in this first period of finds, up through about the mid-1940s, when we're talking about Homo erectus, we're talking about an exclusively Asian lineage. Okay? We're talking about a lot of different types of Asian Homo erectus, and when we think about what Homo erectus is, at that time, if you were to go back and think about a definition of Homo erectus, it would be a definition that was entirely derived from the Asian material. And if you look quickly at this list of characters here, you'll notice that a number of the characters that are up here are characters that showed up when Meave was talking about Fred's work on the Ilurette specimen, a number of characters that are no longer perhaps valid for identifying the taxon. Okay. Homo erectus was, though, firmly a hominid. It was firmly back on the modern human lineage, but note that this was a pretty unilineal kind of view of human evolution at that point in time. If we move into what I kind of categorize as the second period of discovery of Homo erectus, we see that the second period is in fact really dominated by the African finds. First at Olduvai Gorge with OH9 and OH12, which will then subsequently be forgotten, but that's okay. And then at Kubifora, where importantly Homo erectus gets a face. And I think this is one of the reasons why the African material becomes such a centerpiece for thinking about Homo erectus, is because we actually get some nice faces attached to these brain cases. And faces are very much about what we identify with in terms of looking at each other every day, and they're also what become iconic for us in terms of Homo erectus. So this face, when you say Homo erectus to somebody, this face is often what they conjure up in their minds. So Homo erectus gets a face, and Homo erectus also gets a body. Okay? Emphasis on a body, right? There is one body. There are other postcranials that we're not entirely sure who they go with, and we assume the big ones go with Homo erectus, and we assume the littler ones go with Homo habilis. But this body is very important because, as we heard earlier in the morning, and everyone else has done my work for me, so I don't have to explain it too much, but one of the things that that body draws into sharp focus is this idea that Homo erectus was big, that Homo erectus was sort of in the range of modern human size as well as modern human proportions. And here we have a rendition by the artist John Gerchi of a Homo habilis female and a Homo erectus female, sort of depicting that difference in mean body size. And as we learned this morning, differences in body size say a lot about differences in home range. They've led us to infer things potentially about the quality of diet and perhaps a higher quality diet in Homo erectus. And those have led to ideas about why it was that Homo erectus dispersed and Homo habilis didn't. And I know you're saying, but, demonisi, and we'll get there. In this middle period of discovery for Homo erectus, ideas were very much dominated by the finds in Africa, but I don't want to leave you with the impression that there were not being finds made in Indonesia. In fact, there were a lot of finds being made in Indonesia. Indonesian Homo erectus also got a face. There were a lot more finds from different parts of Sanuran. There were finds also from the later Pleistocene deposits in Java. So there were a lot of finds still being made. They didn't sort of take on the iconic importance that the African material did. And this is for a number of reasons. It's partly because they seemed, I think in a sense, to be telling us something that we thought we already knew about Asian Homo erectus or Indonesian Homo erectus. So it was like, okay, well, there's one more and it looks like an Indonesian Homo erectus. Part of it has to do sort of with access and availability to primary specimens for research, but also to casts of those specimens. So because of the very good infrastructure in the casting program at Kenya National Museums, almost every paleoanthropology lab you walk into has a 3733. That is the Kubiphora specimen with the face on it. But many fewer will have a Sanuran 17, and virtually none will have any of these. And so what students got trained on, what people thought about when they were sort of comparing and thinking about their own things in their labs back at home had more to do with African Homo erectus than it did with Asian Homo erectus. So in the second period of finds that I've sort of loosely depicted here, there are finds from all of these different geographic regions, but the African ones tend to take on a lot more importance. And the comparison tends to start to be between the more complete of the African specimens and the more complete of the Asian specimens, which means a tendency to start to compare between early African Homo erectus, somewhere around 1.7, 1.6, 1.5 million years ago, with the Chinese Homo erectus, which are somewhere around 500,000 years old. So you have a couple of things going on here. You're comparing specimens from different geographic regions. You're comparing specimens from different time periods. You're probably comparing specimens of different ages and sexes. So there's a lot of variability that are going into these comparisons. And so there could be a lot of things that these differences between these two individuals might be due to, not the least of which is that they just happen to be two individuals. But this sort of argument tended to break down during this time period into conversations about was this geographic variation between African morphs and Asian morphs, or was this species level differences? The definition of Homo erectus definitely expanded because we got the African material. We got information about body size. We got information about potentially smaller brain sizes. We got information about variability of expression. And you'll note also in Meve's talk this morning that some of this variability has started to be filled in a bit by new finds in Africa that are sort of showing Asian plus African characters. And the definitions and the discussions about species started to get more complicated, too. Instead of that nice unilineal sort of theme with Homo erectus giving rise to Neanderthals, giving rise to humans, we have this sort of complicated phylogeny that Bernard published in 1985, where you have at least two species, ergaster and erectus, with maybe erectus now no longer being on the line to modern humans, maybe being a side branch. So we're back to Homo erectus being a side branch, but at least it's a side branch that's a hominid, not a side branch that's a non-human ape. So we get into now our current period of discovery, and it's one that very clearly, and Dotto showed this very nicely with his discovery, it's very clearly dominated by the finds at Dmanisi. And what's new here? The finds at Dmanisi are new here. And one of the things that's really wonderful about the finds at Dmanisi is they all do seem to represent a small period of time as you've expanded, and they're really little. They made us sort of stretch our thinking about what size meant in Homo erectus because they're really little. And everybody looks at them and goes, oh, but they're really little. They're really too little to be Homo erectus because Homo erectus is big, right? Homo erectus is like us. This is a wonderful sample. The issue of size is really paralleled by some of the new finds in Africa. The Illarett specimen that Meve talked about this morning, the Alorgasile specimen that maybe Rick will talk about this afternoon, I don't know, as well as this long-forgotten OH12, who's also really tiny, cranial capacity of 750 cc's, not so different than what we see at Dmanisi. So just to give you an idea of what was going on in terms of brain size, before the Dmanisi hominids, we had basically no overlap between adult Homo erectus from either Africa or Java and Homo habilis. These are subadults here. And with Georgia, there's actually quite a lot of overlap. And note, this is just 1.5 to 1.8. So if you actually plot in OH12, which is much later in time, we actually did have some overlap, but we sort of ignored it because that made the distinction of big Homo erectus, little Homo habilis kind of messy. Well, Dmanisi has made life a little messy because morphologically, as Dotto explained, very like Homo erectus. Size-wise, really tiny. Okay. Finds in Indonesia during this later time period actually also echo this issue about size and how important size and scaling is to our understanding of characteristics in Homo erectus. So the recent find of SM4, that is Sambumakan 4 versus SM3, these are both specimens that come from the very late Pleistocene of Java. They're about the same age as the Nandong material in Java, and Nandong is known as being very big, 1,100 cc's, 1,200 cc's. Well, Sambumakan 3 is only 900 cc's. Now, compare this littler one with the bigger one, and one of the things that it shows us about scaling and shape differences with size has to do with the shape of the vault. We talked about an angular vault in Homo erectus. Well, you tend to get an angular vault when you do have a longer cranial base. Shorter cranial base, much more rounded globular vault, much finer cranial superstructures. The things that Meve alluded to this morning in terms of being size related, when you start to actually think about size as a variable and how it affects other variables that we might use to define Homo erectus, you start to realize that all of our samples, our African samples, certainly the Dmanisi samples, as well as the Asian samples, show you a lot of size variation. And if you start to pay attention to that, you can maybe tease out what are good Homo erectus characters, or as Meve called them, valid Homo erectus characters versus invalid characters. So this last period of time, definitely dominated by the wonderful Dmanisi finds and absolutely dominated by this idea of size and scaling. And the only reason we can start to talk about the relationships between size and characters is because we have a pretty robust sample, right, in terms of numbers of specimens. Our definition is starting to expand. Some people, if we want to talk about being a little bit more splittatious, that's not a word, but splitters, might say, well, this is too much variation. Let's talk about this as separate species. I tend to be more of a lumper than a splitter, so I'll say our definition is expanded. Our size range is enormous, possibly possibly our body size ranges are enormous. I don't know, but I'm thinking that we're probably going that way. A lot of things are very variable in this species. Well, how variable is too variable? This is Lulu. This is a shameless attempt to get my dog into the talk and to make sure that you're all awake and it's really a wonderful picture and she's a fabulous dog and all of those things. But this is also, isn't she fabulous? She's wonderful. She's actually also in there to remind me to talk a little bit about the issue of time. I have four dogs. You can tell there's one tail there. And that's the back of another one there. Three of them are siblings. And if we were to boil them down, well, perish the thought, boil them down and look at their skeletons and compare them to skeletons and talk about variation within Anatolian shepherds, we would be talking in a very narrow sense about that variation, a slice of that variation in a single sort of genetic lineage at a single point in time. Now, if we were to go back to the beginning of Anatolian shepherds and talk about variation and look at their skeletons and compare them to my pack of Anatolian shepherds, we would still, in a geological sense, be talking about variation over a very narrow range of time. So when we think about how much variation is too much variation within that sort of list of expanded characters, we need to think about time. And here's a place where time is a big controversy, an island in Southeast Asia. But here's an opportunity to remind you that if you're comparing this specimen with one of the Chinese specimen, that you're talking about over a million year difference in time between those two. And how do you take time into account when you're talking about variation within a species, or you're trying to define the variation within a species? So I want to make a little plug here for going to sort of time packets of fossils that are generally about the same age. They're never going to be the same age as Lulu and her siblings, or even Lulu's and the 100-year-old Anatolian shepherds, but we can get closer than this particular comparison. This is Marta's slide, which I stole off of the internet somewhere. And one of the things I want to talk about in terms of time is that there's an issue about, we've got our gaster down here, African Homo erectus, there's an issue about when this dispersal, hey, I said the D word, when this dispersal starts out of Africa. This slide argues that it starts a little bit before a million years ago. I'd argue that there's actually good evidence that it starts quite a bit earlier. Not only is there the evidence that Tato talked about in Georgia at 1.7, 1.8 million years ago, but there's also the evidence from Indonesia. And here my colleagues that work in Indonesia are sort of moving around in their seats because we don't necessarily agree on this either. But in 94, there was the beginning of a conversation about chronometric dates in Indonesia that would suggest that we have a relatively early dispersal to Indonesia as well. And these come mostly from the Sanuran Dome, which is an anticline that is domed up between a series of volcanoes. And of course, the lovely thing about volcanoes, when they're active during the time that our hominids are living, is that they give us nice interstratified tufts that we can date. Well, I don't do that, but other people do. The imperial we can date. And these are the results of the study by Carl Swisher and Garnis Curtis on the Sanuran stratigraphy. So they've got dates sort of at the bottom of this black clay series of about 1.9 going up to about a million in the middle of this sandstone series. And this upper portion, known either as the Kabu or now the Bapong Formation, it's a lot of beautiful cross-bedded sandstones in them that yield lovely fossils such as Sanuran 17. And this black clay portion, at least the upper bit of it here, yields really awful-looking things like Sanuran 27. This is the face. For those of you who are having trouble getting oriented, that's a brow ridge right there, and that's an eye there, and that's a nose hole there, and that's another brow. Okay, the face only a mother could love, right? Members of my set of sort of co-Indonesian American workers will argue about whether or not you actually get fossil hominids coming from the black clay zone. And all I can say is that with the difference in taphonomic signatures between what happens to bone in clay versus what doesn't happen to bone in sandstone, is that plastic deformation, to me, is arguing for us having hominids from those black clays. If that's the case, then we have things that are older than about 1.6, maybe as old as 1.7 at Sanurin. You're right, they're not 1.8. And I can't make that argument for the Pernine specimen. But if we have fossils down here, let's take those bits that we have from the bottom of that Sanurin section. Let's not take all of them, just the ones down here. And let's compare those to a similar time frame in the different regions. So let's compare those to the Dmanisi specimens. Let's compare those to the early bits of the Turkana specimens. And then at least we have some kind of a time packet that we might hope to be able to talk about variation within Homo erectus without having to worry about also a lot of temporal variation. And when you do that, you might be able to start answering those questions I posed earlier. So who are this band of scrappy hominids outside of Africa? How are they related to one another? And, oh, heavens, we're not even going to try and approach why disperse. If you do that and you compare, for example, Dmanisi with the African material, you can do this with cranial remains or with the dental remains, you'll find that there are some fairly specific similarities, for example, between this is Dmanisi 211 and the type specimen for Homo ergaster. There are some strong similarities between Africa and Georgia, but there are also some strong similarities between Georgia and Indonesia. So here's one of the older Sanurin specimens compared, this is an upper jaw, compared to the uppers from Dmanisi, as well as comparisons with the lowers. There are some specific similarities there, and you might sort of generalize it by suggesting that Dmanisi has some features which really strongly affiliate it with African material, and it also has some features that affiliate it with the early Javan material. Not necessarily all the Javan material, but the early Javan material. And Philip has made the same suggestion for the crania, at least I think I heard him say this at the last meeting we were at together, where you have some very strong affinities between Dmanisi and the early African material, but you also have some strong affinities between Dmanisi and the early Indonesian material. So you have not an unrelated dispersal. Was it a single dispersal in a single line by a single arrow? No, probably not. But they are somehow related, with Dmanisi looking strongly like the African material, but also somehow articulating with that first material, those first hominids into island Southeast Asia. And then if you were to look at it further through time, which we don't have time to do, you'd see some continuity within the Javanese material, and you'd actually see some evidence for isolation within some of the later Chinese material. Okay. So I would argue that what we have in answer to those three questions that I posed earlier is an early dispersal that's somewhere at the base of this African Homo erectus origin. So we've got an early dispersal, maybe around 1.7 million years ago, that if you take Georgicus and you assign H. Georgicus to all of the Dmanisi stuff, that Georgicus is part of that. There's a relationship there. It's a complicated relationship, not entirely sure what it is, but there's some relationship between those. That this early dispersal is by something that looks like Homo erectus, okay, and that these are all somehow related. And maybe size had something to do with it, and by size, of course, I'm proxying this issue of a higher quality diet. Maybe size, diet, foraging shift had something to do with it. Maybe that's all related in some complex web of sort of ecological changes that are leading to resource changes, that are leading to foraging shift changes, that are leading, as we heard earlier this morning, to increased body size and home range size and blah, 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 that's also leading to increased dispersal potential and eventually a movement into island Southeast Asia. Maybe it is this, and I published that once, that it was this complex web of things. Or maybe it's like that proverbial bear that went over the mountain. Maybe it's like that proverbial, everybody remember that song when they were a kid? The bear went over the mountain. I'm not going to sing it because I have a terrible voice, but the bear went over the mountain, and maybe it was just to see what they could see. And that is something that I can't answer. So thanks to my colleagues and to the organizers.
All right. Well, we're going to take a short break for a coffee break and reconvene at 3:15.